Imagine waking up on a random Tuesday, pouring a cup of coffee, checking your brokerage account, and realizing you don't just have a zero balance.
Oh boy.
Yeah, you are legally obligated to deliver $300 million that you do not have.
Right, which is just terrifying.
Completely terrifying. And you haven't committed fraud, you haven't done anything illegal at all. You simply signed a standard financial contract, without understanding the massive mathematical trapdoor you were standing on.
Exactly.
Welcome to the deep dive. Before we get into how a completely normal investor can legally bankrupt themselves in a matter of hours, I want to do a quick shout out.
Go for it.
This deep dive is brought to you by SurfFuel. They've got a full Series 65 course with like adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing. You can check it out at surfuel.com.
Highly recommend them.
Yeah, they're great. So that terrifying scenario I started with, I mean, it sounds like a movie plot.
It does,
Yeah.
but it is entirely medically accurate in the financial world. I mean, today we're looking at a massive stack of study materials, client advisory notes, historical market data, and it's all centered entirely around derivatives.
Right. And our mission today for this deep dive is very specific. We are not just going to memorize, dry textbook definitions of options and futures.
No, absolutely not. That won't help you pass the exam, and it won't help you in the real world.
Exactly. We are going to decode the hidden plumbing of the global economy. Like, we want to look at why these instruments exist in the first place, how they behave under extreme stimulus, and most importantly, and this is huge for the Series 65, how you, as a future investment advisor, navigate the strict fiduciary rules of using them for your clients.
That fiduciary lens is literally the key to everything we're going to talk about today.
It really is.
The exam assumes you're sitting across the desk from a client whose financial life is entirely in your hands.
Yes.
It's never just a question of, what a complex financial instrument mechanically
No.
does. The exam pushes you further. It demands to know, is this specific, highly leveraged tool suitable for this very specific human being sitting in front of you?
Yeah, because legality and suitability are two very, very different universes.
Completely different.
And to you listening right now, if you are driving or maybe walking the dog and your eyes usually glaze over at words like time decay or counterparty risk, stick with us. Stay right here.
We are tossing out the dry lecture format today.
100%. We're going to bring in some very specific, really memorable characters today and put them through just absolute financial torture.
It's the best way to learn it.
It is. It ensures these concepts stick in your brain permanently, especially if you get bored easily. No dry textbooks here.
So let's just start right at the beginning. If you want to play in the derivatives casino, you have to pay the cover charge.
Right, the price of admission. Let's talk about options costs, starting with the premium.
Yeah, the premium is the absolute bedrock of options trading. I mean,
Yeah.
it is the primary cost for the buyer of an option.
Okay, so define what it is first, just mechanically.
Sure. At its core, a derivative is just a contract that derives its value from something else, like a stock, an index, a commodity. When you buy an option, you are buying a right, but not an obligation to do something in the future.
Gotcha.
And the premium is simply what you pay for that right.
Right. I always like to visualize this because it makes the mechanics so much more obvious. Buying an option is exactly like putting down a non-refundable deposit on like a wildly specific rental car.
I love this analogy.
So let's say it's summer and you want to rent a vintage bright red convertible for a road trip next month. The rental agency says, sure, we'll hold it for you, but we need a $1,000 deposit today. You pay the $1,000.
Which is a completely sunk cost the moment the transaction clears.
Exactly. It's gone. Now a month goes by, it's time for the trip. But suddenly a massive hurricane hits the coast. I mean, it's just pouring rain.
Yeah, you obviously aren't going to drive a vintage convertible in a hurricane.
No way. And because you only bought the option to rent the car, you don't have to pick it up. You can just walk away.
Right.
You aren't forced to pay the rest of the rental fee. But that $1,000 deposit, that premium, that is gone forever.
It's gone. And it's a perfect analogy because it highlights the asymmetrical nature of options. The buyer's risk is strictly limited to that initial premium. You just can't lose more than your deposit.
Right, which sounds pretty safe.
But on the flip side of that trade is the seller, the person who wrote the contract. They collected your $1,000 up front. They are the ones who took on the obligation.
Ah, so they have to perform if you want them to.
Exactly. If the weather was beautiful and you showed up to claim the car, they would be legally forced to hand you the keys. no matter what.
So just to recap, the buyer pays the premium for the right to walk away. The seller collects the premium for taking on the legal obligation.
You've got it.
But here is where the math gets really interesting and where the Series 65 loves to test your conceptual understanding. That premium isn't just a static number sitting in a bank account. It is constantly bleeding out thanks to a concept called time decay, or theta.
Oh, theta. Time decay is the silent killer of the options buyer. It really is.
Silent killer. Explain that.
When you buy an option, you are acquiring what we call a wasting asset. I want you to imagine you just bought an ice cube and you placed it on a warm kitchen counter.
Okay, melting immediately.
Right. The moment you set it down, it begins to melt. Every single day that ticks by, a little bit of the option's value evaporates, simply because there is less time remaining for the stock to make the massive price move you need it to make.
But let's explain why the math actually works that way. Because understanding the why means you don't have to memorize anything for the test.
Good point.
If I buy an option that requires a stock to jump $20 to become profitable, and I have like 6 months until the contract expires, there's a decent mathematical probability that the stock could actually do that, right?
Precisely. And the market price is in that probability. The more time you have, the higher the probability of a favorable event. Therefore, the option has a higher extrinsic value. People will happily pay more for it.
But here's the flip side. What if I only have 2 days left until expiration and the stock still needs to move $20?
Right.
The statistical probability of a massive $20 spike happening in 48 hours is practically zero.
And that is exactly why the ice cube doesn't just melt linearly. It's not a slow, steady drip. The Series 65 loves to test when time decay happens the fastest.
Okay, this is huge. When does it happen fastest?
For out-of-the-money options, meaning options that are currently not profitable to exercise, the value doesn't just slowly drip away. As you get into the final weeks and days before expiration, someone essentially turns a blowtorch on the ice cube.
A glowtorch? Wow.
Yeah, the value collapses exponentially because the mathematical probability of the option ever becoming profitable is rapidly approaching zero.
Okay, so I want to ask a rhetorical question here just to lock this in for the listener. Okay, think about this. If that option is losing value every single day, if the probability is collapsing and the ice cube is melting under a blowtorch, who is cheering?
Right.
Who benefits from time decay? I'll give you a beat to think about it. If you said the seller, you are spot on.
It has to be the seller.
Yeah.
They collected that non-refundable deposit up front. Their absolute dream scenario is that you, the buyer, just walk away.
They want you to stay home.
Exactly. They want the contract to expire completely worthless so they can keep your $1,000 and do absolutely zero work. Every single day that passes brings the seller closer to that reality.
So time decay is the option writer's best friend.
Best friend. And it is a massive headwind for the option buyer.
That makes so much sense. Before we move off options costs, though, we should probably briefly touch on the real-world friction of trading. Commissions.
Yes. The exam absolutely expects you to recognize that these aren't free transactions.
Right. You pay a broker a transaction fee to open the position, and you pay them again to close it, which, you know, might not sound like a big deal if you're buying a huge, expensive contract.
Right. A few bucks here or there.
But let's say you are buying options that are deeply out of the money and they're trading for pennies. If you buy 1,000 contracts at 5 cents each, and your broker charges you a flat fee per contract, your commissions could easily eat up like 20, 30, or even 40% of your entire capital investment right out of the gate.
Yeah, it's a material drag on performance. And an advisor has to account for that when evaluating suitability.
Absolutely. Okay, so frictional costs matter. But let's shift gears, because while options have non-refundable premiums and melting ice cubes, the futures market operates on an entirely different set of physics.
Completely different.
And this brings us to one of the most brutal traps on the exam. I mean, this catches everybody. The futures margin trap.
Ooh, this is a big one.
Okay, to explain this, we need to introduce our first character today. Enter Forgetful Fred.
I like Fred already.
Fred is a guy who just opened a new brokerage account. He has heard, you know, a lot of podcasts about commodity trading, and he decides he wants to trade oil futures. But Fred doesn't actually read the rule book. He just clicks buttons on his app while he's at the beach.
Classic Fred.
Now, Fred has traded normal stocks before, so he knows how securities margin works.
Right. In the stock market, if Fred wants to buy $10,000 worth of index funds, but he only has $5,000 in cash, he can use margin.
Just normal margin.
Right. He puts down his $5,000, he borrows the other $5,000 from his broker, and he buys the stock. It's a loan. He pays interest on that borrowed $5,000 every single month.
So Fred logs into his futures account. He sees an oil contract with a total notional value of $100,000. The broker says he only needs to post $10,000 in margin to control it.
Uh-oh.
So Fred thinks, great, I'll put up my $10,000, the broker will loan me the other $90,000, and I'll just pay a little interest.
Right.
I mean, that makes logical sense.
And that is the exact trap that wipes people out on the exam. Stop what you are doing right now and mentally highlight this. Futures margin is entirely different from stock market margin.
Wait, how different?
Futures margin is not a loan, period. Fred is not borrowing $90,000 from his broker.
Okay, wait, if he's not borrowing money, what is the $10,000 he just handed over? What did he just do?
It is a performance bond. It's a good faith deposit. When you enter a futures contract, you aren't actually buying the oil today. You are making a legally binding promise to buy the oil in the future. The broker just needs to know you are good for it. So they require you to post collateral, a performance bond, to prove you have some skin in the game in case the price of oil moves against you.
This is such a critical distinction for the test. So because it's a performance bond and not a loan, what is the interest rate Fred pays on that $90,000?
Zero. There is absolutely no interest charge on futures margin because there is no debt. If you see a test question asking you to calculate the interest expense on a futures margin account, the answer is zero. It's a trick designed to see if you actually understand the underlying mechanism.
Okay, but there is still a cost to Fred, right?
Yeah.
If he's not paying interest, what is the actual burden of tying up that $10,000?
The burden is pure opportunity cost. Fred takes $10,000 in cash and basically locks it in a vault at the brokerage firm to act as his performance bond.
Right.
He can't use that money to buy stocks.
Yeah.
He can't put it in a money market fund yielding 5%. It is dead money, sitting there solely to guarantee his future performance.
And this is where things go horribly, horribly wrong for forgetful Fred. So Fred buys his oil futures contract. But like I said, Fred is forgetful. He's at the beach. He ignores his phone. He doesn't watch the market. And over the next 3 days, the price of oil starts dropping.
And here is the second massive mechanism you must understand about futures. They are marked to market every single day.
Okay, let's walk through this day by day so the math clicks for everybody listening.
Let's do it.
Day one, Fred's performance bond, his initial margin is $10,000. That afternoon, oil drops. And Fred's contract loses $1,000 in value. What happens?
The clearinghouse literally reaches into Fred's account and deducts $1,000 in cash, transferring it directly to the person on the winning side of the trade.
Immediately.
Immediately. So Fred's performance bond is now down to $9,000.
Okay, day two. Oil tanks again. Fred loses another $2,000. The clearinghouse deducts it. Fred is now sitting at $7,000.
And now Fred has crossed a dangerous threshold.
Yeah.
Every futures contract has an initial margin requirement, which is the amount to open the trade, and a maintenance margin requirement.
The maintenance margin.
Right. The maintenance margin is the absolute minimum floor the broker will tolerate. Let's say the maintenance margin for this oil contract is $8,000. Fred is at seven. He has breached the floor.
He broke through the floor. And this triggers the dreaded margin call. The broker's risk management system sends an automated screaming alert to Fred's phone. Your good faith deposit has fallen below the acceptable limit. Send cash immediately.
Now, here is the exact question the Series 65 will throw at you.
Okay, listener, wake up for this one.
Fred's maintenance margin line is $8,000. His account is at $7,000. Does Fred just need to deposit $1,000 to get his head back above the $8,000 waterline?
Think about it. The floor is eight. He's at seven. A logical person would think, just give him $1,000 to get back to the floor.
Right. It makes sense.
But the answer is no, absolutely not.
He has to deposit what is known as variation margin. And the rule is highly punitive.
Highly punitive.
Yes. When you breach the maintenance margin in a futures account, you do not just restore the account to the maintenance line. You must deposit enough variation margin to restore the account all the way back up to the initial margin level.
Wow. Okay, so let's do the math for Fred. Initial was 10,000. Maintenance was 8. He dropped to 7. He has to wire $3,000 in cash immediately to get back to the $10,000 starting line. Not 1,000, 3,000.
Exactly.
And if forgetful Fred is still on vacation and ignores his phone and misses that margin call,
the broker doesn't wait. They don't send a polite follow-up email asking how his vacation is going. they will immediately liquidate Fred's oil position at whatever terrible market price is currently available, lock in his massive losses, and probably send his account into a deficit that he still legally owes them. It is high velocity, brutal risk management.
That is wild. So after watching Fred get completely wiped out by a variation margin call and realizing that options buyers are just watching an ice cube melt into nothing, you know, you really have to wonder, why would anyone with serious hard-earned wealth ever touch these instruments?
Great question.
Which brings us to our second phase today, section two. We need to look at the why. Why do conservative advisors use derivatives? We are shifting the mindset here from aggressive speculation to pure defensive paranoia.
I love that framing.
Good.
Because when we talk about advisory clients, the dominant use case for derivatives isn't gambling, it's hedging. It is institutional grade risk management.
Right. Which brings in our second character today, Cautious Carl.
Cautious Carl. Let's hear it.
Carl is a guy who has spent 40 years building a business. He recently sold it, and he was paid mostly in company stock. So let's say he owns $5 million in shares of a massive tech company. Carl is wealthy, but he is incredibly anxious.
Like a lot of clients.
Yeah. He watches the financial news channels all day. Mm-hmm. He constantly worries that a black swan event, you know, a pandemic, a war, a sudden recession is going to crash the market tomorrow and wipe out his life savings.
It keeps him up at night.
He loves his tech stock. He doesn't want to sell it and trigger massive capital gains taxes, but he is terrified of a crash.
Cautious Carl desperately needs a sleep at night strategy. And the absolute perfect tool for him in this scenario is something called a protective put.
The protective put. Okay. Mechanically, this means he is long the stock and he goes long a put option.
Right.
The traditional textbook analogy here is that buying a put option is like buying a concrete bunker for your portfolio. But I actually think that metaphor fails to explain the true mechanics.
Oh, how so?
Well, a bunker just blocks damage. You hide in it and nothing happens. A protective put is much more dynamic. It is literally buying an insurance policy with a strict deductible.
That is a much better way to think about it. Let's trace the mechanics of that insurance policy. A put option gives the buyer the right, but not the obligation, to sell the underlying stock at a specific strike price before a specific expiration date, regardless of how low the actual market price plummets.
Okay, let's put numbers to it. Carl's stock is currently trading at $100 a share. He goes to the options market and buys a protective put with a strike price of $90 expiring in 1 year. He pays a premium for this. Let's say he pays $5 a share. That $5 is his non-refundable insurance premium.
Exactly. Now, let's say Carl's worst nightmare comes true. A global banking crisis hits. The market completely panics.
Total meltdown.
The tech company he owns announces terrible earnings, and the stock price craters from $100 all the way down to $10 a share.
Oh, man. I mean, that is a total wipeout for a normal investor. But Carl has his insurance policy.
Exactly. Carl is contractually protected. He picks up the phone, calls his broker, and exercises his put option. He legally forces the person who sold him that put to buy all of his shares for $90 each, even though they're only worth $10 in the real world.
So let's look at his true loss. The stock fell $90, but Carl was guaranteed 90 bucks a share. He lost the $10 between the original $100 price and his $90 strike price. That's his deductible.
Right, the deductible.
And he lost the $5 he paid in premium up front. So his maximum loss in a total market collapse was strictly contained to $15 a share. He literally saved his fortune.
It's beautiful. But here is the most powerful part of the protective put, and honestly why advisors love it so much. What if Carl's paranoia was completely wrong?
Which happens a lot.
Right. What if the market doesn't crash? What if the tech company announces a revolutionary new AI product and the stock rockets from $100 to $500 a share over the next year?
This is where it beats a concrete bunker. If you are in a bunker, you can't participate in the sunshine.
Exactly.
But with a protective put, Carl preserves absolutely unlimited upside. If the stock goes to 500, Carl just ignores his put option. He lets the ice cube melt.
He just walks away.
Yeah. The option expires worthless and he loses his $5 premium. But who cares? His stock is now worth $500 a share.
It is the ultimate asymmetrical payoff for a wealthy, concentrated investor. He strictly defined and limited his maximum potential loss, but he kept his exposure to infinite potential gains. He just paid a small friction cost, the premium, for that total peace of mind.
Unlimited upside, strictly defined downside. That is the hallmark of the protective put. Make sure you remember that for the test.
Crucial point.
But let's change Carl's psychology for a minute. Let's say a few years pass. Carl isn't anxious anymore. He looks at his tech stock, and it's just been stuck at $100 a share for 18 months. It just trades sideways. Up a dollar, down a dollar. Carl is bored.
The boredom face.
Right. He tells his advisor, look, my outlook is flat to slightly bullish. I don't think it's going to crash, but I also don't think it's going to the moon anytime soon. But I have millions tied up in this lazy stock. I want it to generate some yield.
So if the client's outlook is flat and their primary objective is income generation, the advisor is going to pull a completely different tool out of the toolbox, the covered call.
Okay, long stock plus a short call. So Carl is now stepping into the shoes of the seller. Explain how he generates income here.
Well, when you write or sell a call option, you are taking on an obligation.
Mm.
Carl is offering a contract to the market. He is basically saying, I promise to sell my shares of stock to anyone who wants them at a strike price of $110 anytime in the next 6 months.
And because he is taking on that legal obligation, he gets paid. He collects the non-refundable deposit.
Yes. Let's say a speculator buys Carl's contract and pays him a premium of $5 a share. That cash is immediately deposited into Carl's account. It is his to keep forever. He has just generated instant yield on a stock that wasn't moving at all.
Instant yield. But, you know, the golden rule of finance is that there is no free lunch.
Never.
What is the trade-off Carl just accepted to get that cash?
By selling that call option, Carl has explicitly capped his upside potential. Let's say that tech company announces the AI breakthrough a week later and the stock rockets to $500 a share.
Oh boy. The speculator who bought the contract is going to call Carl and say, hey buddy, I'm exercising my right. Hand over your shares for $110 just like you promised.
And Carl has to do it. He legally has to sell his shares at $110. Now he gets to keep the $5 in premium, so his total economic exit is $115. But he has to sit there and watch the stock trade at $500 in the open market, knowing he missed out on hundreds of dollars per share in profit.
Ouch. So we need to do a direct side-by-side comparison right now, because the Series 65 will test your ability to differentiate these two hedging strategies based strictly on client intent.
Yes, pay close attention to this.
Strategy one, the protective put. You are the buyer. You pay a premium. Your goal is insurance against the crash, the trade-off. You lose the premium, but you keep unlimited upside.
Perfect.
Strategy two, the covered call. You are the seller. You collect a premium. Your goal is income in a flat market, the trade-off. You get immediate cash, but you strictly cap your upside profit.
That is the exact mental model you need. Protective put for the fearful bull. Covered call for the yield-hungry flat market investor.
Now, beyond hedging, we have to talk about leverage and flexibility. We throw the word leverage around a lot. It basically just means amplifying your financial power, doing more with less capital.
It's the physics of a crowbar applied to money.
A crowbar. I like that.
Yeah, if you want to buy 100 shares of $100 stock, you need to write a check for $10,000. That's a massive capital commitment. But if you buy one call option contract, which controls 100 shares, you might only pay a premium of $500.
So you've tied up only $500, but you control $10,000 worth of the underlying asset.
And this creates massive percentage returns. If the stock goes up 10% from 100 to 110, the guy who bought the stock outright made $1,000. A 10% return on his $10,000 investment.
Which is not bad. What about the options buyer?
The options value will essentially move dollar for dollar with the stock once it's in the money. So that option contract gains $1,000 in intrinsic value. The options buyer only invested $500 initially. They just made a 200% return on their capital, while the stock only moved 10%.
Wow. 200% versus 10%.
That is the raw, intoxicating power of leverage.
But I want to highlight something really specific in the syllabus here regarding leverage, the index option multiplier. When we talk about options on an index like the S&P 500, we aren't dealing with physical shares of a single company. You can't deliver a box containing one share of the S&P 500.
Right. Index options are cash settled. There is no physical delivery of shares. And to standardize the contract size, the industry uses a multiplier, which is almost universally $100.
Okay, so let's do the math. If you're looking at an S&P 500 index option and the index is currently trading at 5,000 points, you don't just have $5,000 of exposure. You take the index level of 5,000 and multiply it by 100.
Right.
One single index option contract represents $500,000 in notional exposure.
It's massive. And it's incredibly efficient for advisors.
Yeah.
If Cautious Carl didn't just own one tech stock, but instead had a massively diversified portfolio mirroring the entire S&P 500, he wouldn't go out and buy 500 individual protective puts on all those companies.
The commission costs would completely destroy him.
They would. So he would just buy a few S&P 500 index puts. Because of that massive notional value in the $100 multiplier, he can hedge his entire portfolio against systematic risk, which is the risk that the entire macro economy collapses with just a handful of transactions.
That was super efficient. And before we leave this section on why advisors use derivatives, we have to give some breathing room to a unique instrument that often gets buried in the textbook, warrants.
Warrants. Warrants are a fascinating corner of corporate finance.
Yeah, explain them.
You can think of a warrant as a call option, but with three major differences. Who issues it, how long it lasts, and why it exists. Standard options are created by other investors on an exchange. Warrants are issued directly by the company itself.
Interesting. And while a normal call option might expire in, say, 3 months or 9 months, warrants are incredibly long duration.
Very long.
They might not expire for 2, 5, or even 10 years. They give you the right to buy stock directly from the corporate treasury at a fixed price far into the future. But why do companies issue them?
They are almost universally used as a sweetener for corporate debt. I want you to imagine a struggling company that desperately needs to borrow $50 million to build a new factory. They go to the bond market. But because they are struggling, investors demand a brutal interest rate, maybe 12%, to take on the risk.
And the company can't afford 12% interest. It would bankrupt them before they even built the factory.
Exactly. So the company gets creative. They go back to the investors and say, "We will only pay you 7% interest. However, attached to these bonds, we will give you a stack of warrants."
Ah, the sweetener.
"If our new factory is a massive success and our stock price explodes over the next 5 years, these warrants will allow you to buy our stock for pennies on the dollar. You will make an absolute fortune."
It sweetens the deal. The investor accepts a lower yield today in exchange for massive long-term equity upside. And importantly for the exam, once these bonds are issued, the warrants can often be detached, right?
Yes. The investor can keep the bond for the safe 7% yield and go sell the warrants separately on the open market to a speculator.
They are a really powerful tool for capital raising. But as we move away from the benefits of leverage and hedging, we have to confront the dark side. It is time to enter Section 3.
The danger zone.
The danger zone. Where there is leverage, there is catastrophic risk if you don't respect the math. We've talked about the risks for the buyer. We know about the melting ice cube of time decay. We know you can lose 100% of the premium you paid. And there is a slow bleed opportunity cost to constantly buying protective insurance. You know, if the market just grinds upward for a decade, the guy who bought and held will vastly outperform the guy who kept spending 2% of his portfolio every year on protective puts.
Yes, buyer risk is painful. Mm-hmm. But it is quantifiable. It is mathematically contained. Rider risk, the risk of the seller, is where financial careers go to die.
Wow. And to explore this, we are bringing in our third and final character today, Wild Wanda.
Oh, Wild Wanda.
Wild Wanda is a rogue trader. She hates rules. She hates hedging. She thinks Cautious Carl is a total coward, and she wants to make maximum yield using maximum leverage. So Wanda decides she is going to sell a naked call.
The naked call, also known as an uncovered call. Listen closely. This is the single most important, highly tested risk concept in this entire module. If you learn nothing else today, understand the mechanics of the naked call.
Okay, let's contrast this so it's perfectly clear. When Cautious Carl sold a covered call, he already owned the tech stock. He promised to sell it, but it was sitting right there in his vault.
Safe and sound.
Wild Wanda sells a naked call. This means she writes a legally binding contract promising to sell 100 shares of a company to someone at a fixed price. But she does not actually own a single share of that company.
None. She is selling something she doesn't possess, hoping the option expires worthless so she can just pocket the premium. But if she is wrong, the theoretical risk she has exposed herself to is terrifying.
We don't even need a hypothetical analogy here. We can just look at actual market history. Let's look at the GameStop short squeeze in early 2021. The mechanics of a short squeeze perfectly illustrate the infinite risk of a naked call.
It's the perfect historical parallel. Let's say Wanda wrote naked calls on a struggling video game retailer. The stock was trading at $10. She promised to sell it at $15, collecting a tiny premium, confident the dying company would never reach $15.
But then, millions of retail investors organize on social media. They realize the stock is heavily shorted, and they start buying it relentlessly. The price rockets from $10 to $20 to $50 to $100 to $300 a share in a matter of days.
Just absolute chaos. And now, look at Wanda's legal position. The person who bought her call option exercises it. They say, Wanda, you promised to sell me 100 shares at $15. Deliver them.
But Wanda doesn't own the shares.
Excellent.
She has to go out into the open chaotic market during a massive short squeeze and buy the shares herself to fulfill her contract. So she logs into her broker. The stock is currently trading at $300. She's forced to buy it at $300 just to immediately turn around and hand it to the contract buyer for $15.
She loses $285 per share.
Instantly.
And here is the core exam principle. What if the squeeze didn't stop at 300?
Right. What if Elon Musk tweeted about it and massive hedge funds panicked and the stock went to 1,000 or 10,000? Because it is an equity stock, there is theoretically no ceiling on how high the price can go. It can rise to infinity.
And therefore, the cost for Wanda to acquire that stock to fulfill her legal obligation can also rise to infinity. This is the exact blind spot that wipes out even seasoned traders.
So, listener, if you see the words naked call or uncovered call on the Series 65, you immediately, instinctively look for the answer choice that says unlimited maximum loss.
Unlimited. It is the single most dangerous position in all of finance.
Okay, so Wanda gets completely decimated on her naked call, but she is wild Wanda. She doesn't quit. She pivots. She decides that if naked calls are too dangerous, she'll just write naked puts.
Okay, here we go.
Let's trace this. A put is the right to sell. So if Wanda writes a naked put, she is making a legally binding promise to buy a stock at a specific strike price, even though she doesn't actually have the cash sitting in her account to do it. Let's say she promises to buy a stock at $50 a share.
And then the company gets investigated for accounting fraud. The stock goes into freefall. The buyer of the put exercises their right. They force Wanda to buy the plunging stock at $50.
Okay, stop the tape. Direct question to you listening. You know the naked call has unlimited risk because a stock can go to infinity. Is Wanda's maximum loss on a naked put also unlimited? Think about the physical mechanics of a stock price.
I'll give you a second.
Okay, if you said yes, you fell for it.
This is a trap that catches a lot of test takers who rely on rote memorization instead of logic. They memorize naked equals unlimited risk. But that is completely false for a put.
Why? Because what is the worst possible thing that can happen to a fraudulent company's stock?
The company is delisted, it goes bankrupt, and the stock goes to zero.
Right. A stock cannot go to negative infinity. You can't have a stock price of negative $500. The absolute floor is zero.
So if the stock goes to zero, Wanda is contractually forced to buy a completely worthless asset for $50.
Yeah.
She loses $50 per share minus the small premium she collected up front.
Which is brutal.
It is a devastating substantial loss. It might wipe out her account, but mathematically, it is a strictly limited loss. It is completely defined by the strike price minus the premium. It is not unlimited.
I love that breakdown. That is so clear. Naked call, unlimited risk, because the ceiling is infinite. Naked put, substantial but limited risk, because the floor is zero.
Spot on. Now, let's briefly touch on three other systemic risks that advisors must consider when evaluating derivatives. The first is complexity risk.
This is the idea that derivatives don't move in straight lines, right? Like if you buy a share of Apple and Apple goes up $5, you make $5. It's linear. But if you buy an option, the underlying stock can move in the exact direction you predicted, but you can still lose money.
Exactly, because of the Greek variables in options pricing. You might have been right about the direction, but wrong about the timing, so time decay eats your profit. Or you were right about direction, but volatility suddenly collapses, which drains the extrinsic value of the option.
It's just inherently complex.
The payout profile is non-linear and highly complex, which means clients often don't understand why they're losing money when they thought they guessed right.
Next is liquidity risk.
We mentioned earlier that standard options are exchange traded, but that doesn't guarantee liquidity. If you buy a highly customized option, or one that is deep out of the money, or one that expires 2 years from now, there might not be an active secondary market for it.
Right. You might look at your screen and see the option is worth $1,000. But when you hit the sell button, you realize The bid-ask spread is monstrous. The highest bidder is only offering you $600.
You are trapped.
If you need to exit the position immediately, you have to accept a massive haircut just to find a buyer.
And finally, speculation risk, which is simply the velocity of capital loss. Because of the extreme leverage, your maximum loss might only be your initial premium, but you could lose 100% of that initial capital in a matter of hours. The velocity of destruction is much higher than buying and holding equities.
Which brings us to section four. We are stepping out of the options market and organizing the ultimate showdown. We are putting forward contracts and futures contracts into the ring together.
This is a classic high-yield exam comparison.
I feel like to a layperson, they sound exactly the same. They both lock in a price for a future transaction, but structurally, mechanically, and legally, they are entirely different species of derivatives.
Yes. We need to build a mental wall between these two. Let's start on the futures side of the wall.
Sure.
We know this from Forgetful Fred's oil trade.
Right. Futures are highly standardized. They trade on a heavily regulated centralized exchange, like the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Because they are standard, they are highly liquid. You can trade in and out of them constantly.
And as we saw with Fred, they settle daily. They are marked to market every single afternoon.
Standard size, exchange traded, liquid, daily settlement. That's futures. Now look over the wall at forward contracts.
Forwards are the bespoke tailor shop of the financial world.
Yeah.
They do not trade on a centralized exchange. They trade over-the-counter, or OTC. They are entirely private, customized contracts negotiated directly between two specific parties.
I always picture like a giant agricultural conglomerate. Let's say they need to lock in the price of a very specific, weird, low-grade type of wheat. And they need it delivered not to a major hub, but to a very specific grain elevator in rural Nebraska on a random Tuesday 7 months from now.
Right.
They can't go to the Chicago Mercantile Exchange for that. There is no standard contract for weird wheat in Nebraska on a Tuesday.
Precisely. So that conglomerate has to call up an investment bank and negotiate a custom forward contract. Because it is highly customized, there are significant negotiation and legal costs. And because it is customized, it is wildly illiquid.
Right. If the conglomerate suddenly decides they don't want the wheat, they can't just click sell on an app. Nobody else in the world wants that specific wheat at that specific silo on that specific Tuesday. They're locked in.
Forwards are heavily used by massive institutions, governments, banks, multinational corporations to hedge highly specific exposures like foreign currency exchange rates or interest rate swaps.
Okay, that's the structural setup. But here comes the knockout punch. The massive exam gotcha that you absolutely must understand. We have to talk about counterparty risk.
Counterparty risk is the terrifying possibility that the guy on the other side of your trade goes bankrupt, defaults on his obligation, and leaves you holding a worthless piece of paper.
Let's look at futures first. Why did Forgetful Fred not have to worry about the guy selling him the oil?
Because of the clearinghouse. When you trade on a futures exchange, you aren't actually contracting with another human being. The exchange's clearinghouse steps into the middle of every single trade through a legal process called novation.
Novation, got it.
The clearinghouse becomes the buyer to every seller, and the seller to every buyer. They guarantee the performance of the contract. If the guy who shorted the oil goes bankrupt, Fred doesn't care. The clearinghouse pays Fred out of its massive reserve funds. Therefore, exchange-traded futures have virtually zero counterparty risk.
But forwards are OTC. They are just a private agreement between two entities. There is no exchange. There is no clearinghouse.
And this is where we have to look at the 2008 financial crisis.
Oh, this is a great example.
Specifically, the collapse of the insurance giant AIG. This isn't just history. It explains the exact mechanism the exam tests. AIG wrote hundreds of billions of dollars in OTC forward contracts, specifically credit default swaps, insuring mortgage bonds.
They made private promises to banks all over Wall Street. They said, if the housing market crashes, we will pay you.
But there was no clearinghouse guaranteeing AIG's promise. When the housing market collapsed, all the banks showed up at AIG's door holding these custom forward contracts, demanding to be paid. But AIG didn't have the cash. They were defaulting.
The counterparties, the banks, realized their contracts were worthless because the guy on the other side was bankrupt. The entire global financial system nearly froze because of OTC counterparty risk.
It is the ultimate domino effect.
Uh-huh.
If you see counterparty risk on the exam, you immediately, without hesitation, look for forward contracts or OTC derivatives. Futures use a clearinghouse to eliminate it. Forwards carry it entirely.
Okay, take a deep breath. We have covered the structural mechanics, we've melted ice cubes, navigated margin calls, survived a short squeeze, and avoided the 2008 AIG collapse. Now, we must transition to the most critical part of this deep dive for anyone taking the Series 65, Section 5, the fiduciary filter.
This is where it all comes together.
We are taking off the trader hat, and we are firmly securing the investment advisor hat to our heads. We know how these insane tools work, but how do we use them legally and ethically for our clients without losing our licenses?
The foundational rule of the Series 65 is this: derivatives are highly complex, highly leveraged instruments, and they are inherently unsuitable for the vast majority of retail investors.
As a fiduciary, you cannot just read a blog post about how covered calls generate great yield and decide to put your entire book of clients into them.
No, you must run every single recommendation through the fiduciary filter.
Which means doing the hard work of assessing the client. You have to document their exact risk tolerance, their primary investment objectives. Are they seeking growth, income, or capital preservation?
You have to assess their prior trading experience. Do they actually understand what a margin call is? And what is their time horizon?
And this leads to a conceptual point that the regulators absolutely love to test. It is the distinction between what is legal and what is suitable. Legality does not equal suitability.
That is so important.
Let's expand on that. Give me a scenario.
Let's say you have a client who is an 82-year-old widow. She lives entirely on a fixed income generated by a modest portfolio of municipal bonds and dividend stocks. Her stated documented objective is absolute capital preservation. She cannot afford to lose a dime.
Okay, but let's say she has a lot of liquid net worth.
Right. She might have enough cash in the account to legally meet the margin requirements to sell naked call options. She is of sound mind. She signs all the massive risk disclosure documents, and the broker-dealer's compliance department legally approves the options account. The transaction is 100% legal.
But if you, as her fiduciary advisor, recommend that she sell naked calls on volatile tech stocks just to generate a little extra premium.
You have committed a massive fiduciary violation.
Big time.
It doesn't matter that she signed the paperwork. It doesn't matter that it's legal. Exposing an 82-year-old widow seeking capital preservation to theoretically infinite loss is entirely demonstrably unsuitable. Your license would be suspended, and you would likely be sued. Suitability is the ultimate trump card.
Suitability is king. You always have to match the strategy to the specific client's psychological and financial profile. So to lock this in, let's walk through what I call the suitability spectrum. We are going to rank these derivative strategies from a one being the absolute safest to a five being totally radioactive.
Starting at number one on the spectrum, the lowest risk derivative strategy, protective puts.
Cautious Carl's insurance policy. Why is it the safest?
Because you are spending a strictly defined, known amount of money, the premium, to guarantee a hard floor under an existing position. You are mathematically reducing the overall risk of the portfolio. This is highly suitable for conservative investors who hold concentrated wealth in a single stock and are terrified of a market crash.
Number two on the spectrum, covered call writing.
Still relatively conservative, but slightly different intent. This is suitable for flat markets. The client wants income. The risk is low because they already own the underlying stock.
Right. If the option is exercised against them, they just hand over the shares they already possess. There is no risk of them having to buy a billion-dollar stock in a short squeeze.
Exactly. It is suitable for yield-hungry clients who are perfectly fine capping their upside growth.
Number three moves us away from hedging and into aggressive speculation, buying long calls and long puts.
Now, the client isn't insuring anything. They are just betting on directional price movement. The risk is aggressive because they can, and often do, lose 100% of the premium they paid due to time decay.
The melting ice cube.
Yes, it is a wasting asset. However, the downside is strictly capped to that initial premium. It is suitable for aggressive, risk-tolerant clients who want leverage but demand a hard ceiling on their potential losses.
Number four on the spectrum, speculative futures.
Forgetful Fred territory. Very aggressive. The extreme leverage and the daily mark-to-market mechanics mean a small price fluctuation can trigger massive variation margin calls.
You can easily lose much more than your initial performance bond.
Which means this requires constant daily monitoring and deep pockets. It is only suitable for highly experienced, aggressive clients with substantial liquid capital who can withstand severe drawdowns.
And finally, number five, the most radioactive strategy on the spectrum, naked call writing.
Wild Wanda's infinite nightmare. Because the theoretical loss is boundless, This strategy is generally considered unsuitable for almost all standard advisory clients.
To legally defend recommending a naked call to our regulatory panel, you would have to prove the client was exceptionally wealthy, possessed institutional-level training experience, had a massive documented appetite for extreme risk, and fully comprehended that they could lose their entire net worth in a single short squeeze.
It is almost never the right answer for an advisory client.
Let's put this into practice with a rapid-fire matching game. I will give you a client profile, and you tell me the most suitable derivative strategy. Ready?
Ready.
Client is a 30-year-old physician, massive income, zero prior trading experience, absolutely terrified of market volatility, just wants steady retirement growth.
No derivatives whatsoever. Keep it incredibly simple. Broad market index funds, bonds, and traditional asset allocation. Don't introduce complexity where it isn't needed.
Okay, next. Client is a 65-year-old retiree. They have a massive $2 million position in blue chip dividend stocks. The market has been totally flat for 2 years. They want to generate some extra cash flow to pay for an expensive European vacation, and they don't care if they miss out on a sudden bull market run.
Covered call writing. It is the textbook fit for generating immediate income on existing, stable positions while accepting capped upside.
Last one. Client is a 35-year-old tech entrepreneur. Net worth of $10 million. Extremely aggressive. Fully understands leverage, loves taking massive directional bets on commodity prices, but hates paying options premiums.
Speculative futures. They have the capital to absorb margin calls, the risk tolerance for extreme volatility, and they avoid the time decay drag of options.
That is exactly how you dissect suitability questions. You match the mechanical risk of the instrument to the documented reality of the client. All right, we have reached the home stretch. We're going to lock in everything we've discussed with a rapid-fire recap of the top five most highly tested takeaways from this entire deep dive. I want these cemented in your brain before exam day. Number one.
Options asymmetry. Buyers pay non-refundable premiums and suffer a constant bleed from time decay. Sellers collect those premiums up front and mathematically benefit every single day from time decay.
Number two. The futures margin trap. Futures margin is a performance bond, not a down payment, and it is never a loan. Zero interest is charged. And critically, if you breach the maintenance margin, you must deposit variation margin to restore the account all the way back to the initial margin level.
Number three, the extremes of rider risk. Naked calls carry unlimited theoretical risk because a stock price can squeeze to infinity. Naked puts carry substantial but strictly limited risk because a stock price can only fall to zero.
Number four, the showdown. Forwards are custom, OTC contracts that carry massive counterparty risk, remember the AIG collapse. Futures are standardized, exchange-traded contracts with virtually zero counterparty risk because the clearinghouse guarantees every trade.
Number five, the fiduciary filter. Suitability is the ultimate law. Always match the mechanical risk to the client's profile. Protective puts act as insurance. Covered calls act as IMGR generators. And remember, just because a complex trade is technically legal does not mean it is suitable for your client.
Boom. That is the core architecture of derivative characteristics. But before we sign off, we always like to pull back the camera and leave you with a final provocative thought about the broader market structure.
We spent this entire hour talking about how individuals use derivatives. Cautious Carl protecting his nest egg, wild Wanda blowing up her account in a short squeeze. But I want you to consider the sheer terrifying scale of the global derivatives market.
It's massive.
When you add up the notional value of all the options, futures, forwards, and swaps globally, the estimated value is in the hundreds of trillions of dollars.
Hundreds of trillions. That is massively, exponentially larger than the entire global stock market combined.
Precisely. And because of that massive inherent leverage, derivatives don't just react to the stock market anymore. They dictate it.
Wow.
Think about the index option multiplier we discussed. When millions of automated algorithmic computer programs are dynamically hedging their massive options portfolios every single millisecond, buying and selling billions of dollars of the underlying stocks just to keep their risk balanced, they actually create the daily volatility we see.
It's the ultimate example of the tail wagging the dog. The derivative is supposed to track the asset, but the sheer volume of derivatives is now violently thrashing the asset around.
Exactly. When you study for the Series 65, you aren't just memorizing arbitrary textbook rules to pass a multiple choice test. You are learning the hidden mechanical gears that drive the entire global economy. When things get chaotic, when the market crashes violently, it is almost never just people selling stocks. It is the chaotic unwinding of these massive, interconnected derivative positions.
That is wild to think about. The concrete bunker that cautious Carl builds to protect his own house might actually be the mathematical force that shakes the foundation of the entire neighborhood. Well, you now have the tools. You understand the structural math. You know the behavioral traps. You know how to navigate the fiduciary filters. And you know why a naked call and a short squeeze is a fast track to bankruptcy.
You are ready.
You are fully ready to crush this section of the Series 65. Keep studying the concepts, not just the definitions. Focus on the why. And above all, keep your clients out of the danger zone. Until next time.